Good morning, and I want to continue with amortized complexity today. And we were looking at some simple examples last time, incrementing a counter, and now we will look at slightly more interesting ones. Yes. Namely, the queue example. So we want to realize a queue where you can put in things at one end and take them out at the other end. And we have this general framework for amortized complexity analysis, and it requires that we first have a type of operations so we can model the different operations that we have. So simply to represent these operations, I introduce this data type opQ, operations of a queue, for enqueuing some element and for dequeuing the oldest element. And a queue will now be simply implemented by a pair of lists. And the idea is that you put things in at one end into that part, and you take them out of this part. And when you put them in, you always put them on top of the list, so the first element, you put it here as the first element, and if you take something out, you take out the first element here. So this is what happens there. That's the next function that always that we need to define for this framework that we're going to use there, which is defined further up, it takes the name of the operation, the current state of the queue, and gives you back a new queue. So what does the enqueue operation do? If it takes a current queue that consists of let's call this the back and the front of the queue, so it simply adds the element x that you are enqueuing to the back of the queue, and the front of the queue stays unchanged. So this is a constant time operation. DQ is the other way around, and if the front of the queue is not empty, so this is what we do here, the back of the queue stays unchanged, the front of the queue is just, you take the tail, so you remove the first element from the front of the queue. So I haven't bothered to actually return the element. That's for the complexity analysis, that's irrelevant whether you return the first element or you simply get rid of it. We simplified the technicalities by doing this. So this is again a constant time operation, provided the front of the queue is not empty. Now, of course, if the front of the queue is empty, then you have to do something, namely you take the whole back of the queue, you reverse it, and you take the tail of that. Here's an example. If you were to enqueue, if you start with, say, this, and then you enqueue, but you enqueue a whole list, let's say you enqueue the elements 1, 2, 3, then you get this queue. Empty. And if you now want to dequeue something, well, this is empty, you can't do anything. You first have to take this back and reverse it and make that the front. So you first, as an intermediate step, you would go to make this empty and make this the queue 1, 2, 3. And then you actually dequeue it by taking out the 1. So that's what's happening here in the dequeue. And clearly, our analysis will have to be amortized because most of the time, or much of the time, it's constant time, but then this can be arbitrarily expensive, this operation, because you've, in the worst case, accumulated a long back, and that you have to reverse now. These enqueues might be arbitrarily many, and then you get this very expensive DQ operation. But the intuitive explanation why amortized complexity is still constant is that you can think of when you do the enq, you already pay for the reverse operation, because every one of these enq operations could pay one for the reversal that's happening, and for each element that you have enqued, you just need to reverse it once onto the front, and so you're paying for it a constant amount. And this is what this is just the timing function here. It's constant time for enq, and for dq, if the queue is not empty, then it's the cost of the length of the queue, and otherwise it's zero. I'm not quite sure why I took zero now. You could argue that, I think, yes, what I'm counting here is the number of allocated elements on the heap, the number of cons cells. And so tail doesn't allocate anything, but enq allocates one element, and reversal enqs as many reversal allocates as many elements, list elements, as the list is long. So here I'm, of course, by taking the length of the list as the cost for reversal, I am assuming that reversal is linear, so I'm not doing the naive reversal, but I'm doing the intelligent one. And then this framework gets instantiated, and here we simply, where are we? Something happened here which I didn't want to happen. I think I wanted to undo this, never mind. Remember, this framework had an initial argument, what's the initial state of the queue, and that's, of course, the pair of two empty queues. The next function of the framework is just the next function that we've defined up there. There is no invariant, it's just true. Any pair of lists could be a queue. The timing function is the timing function that we've defined up there. And now comes the potential. And the potential of the queue is simply the length of the back. Why is that? The longer the back, the worse it is, because you're then working towards a situation where you have to reverse a long back. And so this is the potential. Or alternatively, you can view it as the longer the back, the more you've paid into your bank account with every enqueue. That's the alternative way of viewing it. And so you have a lot of credit in your bank account to pay for the reversal. And this is the most interesting one. Well, no, it's not the most. This is this states what the upper bound for the amortized cost of operation F is supposed to be. So the upper bound for the enq operation is just 2, and the upper bound for the dq operation is 0. In fact, it turns out, if you look at the details of the proof, which we won't, that the enq operation simply is exactly 2. It's not just an upper bound, it's precise. And the dq operation is exactly 0. Well, I have already argued for that above. If you look at what the next function does for the enq, you have to pay 1 for the allocation of this cons, and you pay another 1 for the in the future for the reversal of this list here. And so that's why the amortized complexity of 2 is the right measure. And dq doesn't have to pay anything. I mean, dq is, it doesn't allocate anything, so it's for free. And the details of these proofs are very simple. There's no recursion going on, so we don't need no induction. It just works out. Questions about that? Then a slight variation, because you might, if you want, this, as I argued, can be arbitrarily bad. With respect to the actual time it takes when you reverse this long back of the queue, you can improve things a little bit. You can improve the worst case by doing the following, where you, this is even a bit more readable. So this is the next function for a variation of the queue. So now I'm still representing the queue as a pair of lists, but I'm doing I'm doing the following. So both enq and dq, the enq operation puts the element A that you're enqing at the front, at the back, and then it calls a balance function. And the dq operation simply takes it out of the front and calls the balance operation. So clearly what's going on here is that we have an invariant where we assume this this first, the front must be non-empty, otherwise we couldn't always apply the tail function. Or at least we must be assuming it's non-empty if the whole Q is non-empty. Of course, eventually the Q could be empty. So what does the balance function do? The balance function takes the state of a Q and it says if the back is smaller than, or less, the size of the back, the length of the, this should really be length. For lists, you can also use the size, but that's a bit misleading. So if the length of the x is less or equal than the length of the y's, then you don't do anything. But if the back of the q is becoming actually larger than the front of the q, then you do the reversal. You make the back empty, and in the front, you put the reversal of the back behind the old front. So you're doing the reversal not just at the point where you need it, but you do it when the back becomes too large. Then you say, okay, now is maybe a good time to do a bit of reversal. And so that you can show this guarantees you that essentially it never becomes arbitrary. It's only half as bad as the previous one in terms of the worst thing that can happen. Because if you do a lot of enqs, say if you do 10,000 enqs, what will happen? You will first, actually I've never figured this out precisely. If you do a lot of enqs, if you do the first one, then already the back is larger than the front, so you put the first one on the front. You have to enqueue two to get another reversal, so it's doubling. So this might even be. It might be logarithmic. I think it might be that the worst case time is not the number of enqueues, but the logarithm of the number of enqueues that you had beforehand. So it's definitely quite a bit better than the original one in the sense of your worst case behavior is better. The amortized complexity, it turns out, is like this here. So your enq is 3, cos is now 3 and not 2 anymore, dq is still 0. So why has the enq become a bit more expensive? The reason is, if you look at the balance operation again, here it is. In the case where the back has become larger than the front, you perform this. And here, you're not just doing the reversal, you're also doing an append. So you're paying more than just for the reversal. You're also paying for an append, and that's why the amortized cost is a bit higher. But yeah, I should really work out what the precise worst case cost here is. Final example, dynamic tables with insert and delete. So remember, these are tables where you can insert new elements and the table grows, and you can also delete. But now, and every time the number of elements that are in the table, sort of when the table overflows, when you've used all your slots in the table, then you double the size of the table and you copy it into the new location. That's the insert, but now there's also a delete function. So we have two operations here, an insert and a delete. And the delete function does the following. So if you are in a state where you have n elements in the table, and the table has size L, and of course n will be less than or equal L, then the delete, of course, removes an element from the table, and let's ignore the boundary case where we have just one element in it. So this is the interesting one. If you divide by 4, then if n minus 1 is less than a quarter, so if the table is less than a quarter full and you subtract another, you delete another one, then you say, divide the size of the table, so you halve the table in size, and of course copy the elements again. So that means if your table is badly underutilized, the space of the table is badly underutilized, you're only using a quarter of the space of the table, then it's time to shrink the table, half the size, and of course copy the elements into the smaller part. And otherwise, the size of the table stays the same. So this is simply the transition function for one delete operation that takes a table of this many elements and this size and gives you a table with one element less and either this size or this size. And the question is, what should the potential function be for such a table? So let's try and work this out. So we have the situation that if the table has L, the table will at any point will have some length L, and here let's assume here is L over 2, roughly, and here a quarter. So this is the number of elements in the table that I'm plotting here on this axis, and the number of elements will always be between here and here. And what's the worst situation when you're here? Because then if the next element comes in, you have to copy all L elements. So here you have to have a high potential. What potential do you have to have here? Well, exactly the potential that can pay for the copying of the full table. So here the potential must be, this won't be quite, it will be a different scale here. So here it will be L. So here the potential at this point will have to be L. What should the potential here be here? If you have exactly half as many elements in the table as the table is large, what potential would you suggest?
You're
guessing, and that's perfectly fine. You're not supposed to know, it's actually, you can do a lot less. In some sense, this is the equilibrium point. This is great. Your half the table is full, so you can still accommodate many elements, but it's also, before you have to shrink, there's also a lot of time. Yes. Zero, I mean, it works for zero. I'm not saying it wouldn't work for L half, but zero is the standard solution, so to speak. So here is probably what the potential should be. And then what should the potential be here, where you are just about to shrink?
So you will also need L, because if you delete from them?
Yes, but you don't need L. Yes, because you have only a quarter of the table is full, and that's all you need to copy. So it'll be L over 4 here. And then you simply guess, well, this is all linear what's going on here, so probably what I need is this line here, that the potential has to increase when you go up until you've reached enough potential to pay for the doubling. And here, similarly, if you keep deleting elements from the table, you have to increase the potential to work up to that point so you can pay for the halving the table. And that's essentially the solution. You just, from these three points, you can work it out. And of course, this is not a proof that the solution works. This is just motivation why this is probably a good a potential function. And that's exactly what we're doing here in the... Oops, where are we? Here. I'm trying to avoid division, so that's why I'm usually often working with multiplication. So the condition says if n is less than L over 2, so if you're in this part, what is the potential? Then it's L half minus n, and that turns out to be the graph of that function, of this part of the function. And otherwise, if you're here, it's 2n minus L, and that's precisely the graph of this function. So, So we have just, this is just a linear description of this picture here. And if you put in the three points here, here, and here, then you'll get out those values that we predicted, L over 2, L over 4, 0, and L. And you can actually generalize this so it works not just for doubling at a certain doubling when the table is full and quartering it when it's become a half, halving it. I'm not even sure you can say that. Let's say halving it when it's only a quarter full. You can also take different ratios, and these typical library implementations of tables, of arrays, typically extensible arrays, they use some handcrafted coefficients that have been tuned by just measuring typical applications, and they won't be 2 and 4, but it'll be something much much more. Some kind of weird rational numbers. And with this idea in mind, you can come up with the right potential function also for other coefficients. And then you get amortized complexity, upper bounds. For the insert operation, it's 3, and for the delete operation, it's 2. So it is still constant time, constant amortized time. Of course, that's something you have to prove, but this function gives you those numbers, and the proofs are here, but I don't want to go through them. There's nothing particularly difficult. Let's just look at one of them. I think the last one is the crucial one. It says, yes, so we have to, it looks terribly unreadable, but this is the upper bound. But still as a case expression of whether we're talking about insert or delete, and we have to show that I think this is the invariant, that your table size is in a certain range, and now you have to prove that the actual time for executing plus the difference in potential. This is the potential afterwards minus the potential beforehand is bounded by this expression. And so the proof is very simple. First, your state S is actually a pair. So we first do apply cases S. And so then we get another assumption S is the pair AB. And then you do another cases F. So we get two cases, one where F is insert and another one, further down. So this is the second subcase is F is delete. And then you simply grind it out and it all works out. So you just have to do the linear arithmetic. Well, it's not quite, it is linear actually, And then it comes out. So that brings us to the end of those simple examples. Any questions here about what we've seen? So then let's go on to something more interesting. Skew heaps. They were actually the data structure to start this whole business of amortized complexity. So, you can also find them in the archive form proofs. And it's a self-adjusting heap or priority queue. And self-adjusting means that when you insert elements in it, it tries to rebalance itself so that you get logarithmic amortized complexity. So the implementation is the standard one for heaps. So they have functions insert, merge, and delmin, and they have logarithmic complexity, and insert and delmin are defined via the merge function in the standard manner that we've seen. So all we need to concentrate on is the merge function. How is that defined? And the implementation, yes, ordinary binary trees. And then invariant is the heap invariant that you always, at the root of each subtree, the element is smaller than or equal than the elements below. And the merge of, if one of the heaps is empty, of course, is the obvious merge. And the interesting one is the one where both heaps are non-empty. And the idea is that you swap the subtrees when descending. So you may remember we had this very naive implementation of merge where you would always, in some fixed order, merge the trees. There we could easily show that, or easily see that in the worst case you would get this long line. So you would the heap would degenerate into a list. And you can avoid that by swapping when you descend, because then it certainly doesn't become a list. It may still become something of linear size, but it looks better. And that's exactly what we're doing here. You swap the subtrees when descending. So this is the definition, and I will actually copy it on the board because we will refer to it. So we have merge of, in the first case, left one, A1, right one, and we call this the heap one, and we have here left two, A2, right two, and we call this the heap two. And what do we do? Well, of course, we have the usual case distinction. If the smaller one is A1, then we produce this heap. Of course, we put the A1 in the middle. But then we merge the heap H2, which is the one that we haven't deleted an element from. So this one remained intact. We've removed the element from A1 and moved it to the root. So we merge A2, H2 here, and R1. And here on the other side you have L1. So here there's this swapping going on. The subtree that used to be on the left side has now moved to the right side, and the subtree, that's essentially what the swapping is about. And and the heap H2 that was the right argument for the merge has now become the left argument for the merge. So of course, if you look at this code, it looks kind of plausible that it permutes things nicely, but whether it really achieves anything is very unclear. So that's where the proof sits in. And otherwise, it's just the dual. You have here we are. We have the merge of H1 and R2, and A2, and here we have L2, I guess. But in terms of left and right, it's the same pattern that you swap things. It's just that whether it's A1 or A2.
So actually, just for fun, why don't we do an example?
So what happens if we have three merges? Maybe we can just that may be over ambitious writing down the example. Let's just without writing it down in terms of formulae, let's see if we can work out what happens in terms of the tree, destroying the tree. So you do a succession of inserts, and remember the insert was always defined, insert X into some heap was the same as merging the where you have the empty tree, X, empty tree, merging that with your current heap. So you start out with the empty heap, and let's insert 1, 2, 3, and see what happens then. So if you've inserted, in the first case, when you've inserted 1, you really get this tree here with just 1 and 2 empty subtrees, and I won't draw the empty subtrees. So what happens if you merge this tree with the tree with a 2? So then we have to see 1 is less than 2, so we certainly get a 1 at the top, and then we get so we're here in this case in the then, so we merge something that's empty. Here's the 1. Here we have the non-empty heap with a 2 in it, and that will be reproduced, and that will already be empty. So I think it should be this one. Please tell me if you disagree. So we have here, this is the 2. So then it's the first argument of the merge. So it's that one. So then you're right. This is the A1 is the 2, and therefore we are actually in this case here, right? Thank you. And that means that we have the I think it's still the same.
It's still the same because H1 is then the tree that contains the 2. So yeah, we still merge on the left.
Yeah, but you're right. We were in the I was pointing out the wrong case, but the result was the same. And
if we're lucky, well, what will happen now? We have we're inserting the 3 into this tree. So the first argument of the merge is just this singleton tree with a 3 in it, and 3 is certainly less than the root 1. So the root 1 stays where it is, and we are in A1 is greater than, so we are in this case here. So we have L2, so that's the left hand side of the second argument, which is the second argument is the original tree. So the left part, so that is the 2 I think should be here, and I think the 3 will move here. So this looks good. Yeah. Proof by incomplete induction. You can at least see in the previous version, I think we would have either generated this line 1, 2, 3 or this line 1, 2, 3, and now we've done a little bit better. Yeah, so it's similar to a leftist heap, where we, in the leftist heap, if you remember, we use the size to do this swapping. Here we just do it all the time and hope that for the best. And we don't need the size information. Functional correctness is not interesting, it's straightforward. This is what we are aiming for, that the actual time for the merge plus the potential difference. So here we have a function with 2 arguments, so the potential difference is the potential after the merge minus the potentials before the merge, and we have 2 of them. And that is bounded by the logarithm of the sum of the sizes of the 2 things that we're merging. Towards the proof, what do we do? Right heavy, that's the key notion here. We call a pair of 2 trees right heavy if the right side is larger than the left side. And so then the right heavy is simply 1 and otherwise it's 0. So we will use this, it looks like a predicate, is it or is it not right heavy, but we will actually use it in an arithmetic fashion, so we use numbers. So we count the number of right-heavy nodes on the left spine. So you go down the left side of the tree and count how many trees on the left side, or how many sub-nodes on the left side, on the left spine, the right one is heavier than the left one. So it's simply a recursion along the left spine. So the recursive function on the left spine, the right heavy nodes. So you keep on recursing down the left spine and you just add up all the right heavy nodes. And then you get this. I'm still always a bit, I see this lemma and I know it's trivial, but I don't have a good intuition for it. Let's actually go through the proof and see if it's obvious. It should be obvious. So let's look at the induction step. So this will be an induction on the tree H, and let's look at the induction step. So we have 2 to the left spine right heavy of a tree of this form, left something right. Okay. So what's that? That's a case distinction. To compute this function here, the first step is without any case distinction. It's 2 to the right heavy of L and R plus left right heavy of L. So that we can already split up. So it's 2 to the right heavy of LR times 2 to the left right heavy of L. And now we can use the induction hypothesis. So we know this is less than or equal to the size plus 1. So since multiplication is monotone, we can just do it in the second argument, 2 to the right heavy of L and R times size of L plus 1. Okay, now comes the case distinction, whether this is actually right heavy or not. So case, to look at the definition, if the size of L is less than the size of R, then we can continue here, and then this is a 1. So we have equal to 2 times size of L, that's 1. Yes, I think let's see where this is heading. And in the end, we want to arrive at the size of this tree here, the induction that we're doing. And so we do want size, what is the size of the tree plus 1? That's the size of left plus the size of right plus 1. So this is what we want to have on the at the end, and that's just the size of the 2 plus 1. So it's size of L plus size of R plus 2, unless I made a mistake. And now we just need to connect those two, and we know that the size of L is less than or equal to the size of R, so I think this should probably hold. Does that make sense? Because of size of L being less than size of R. So you get 2 times, yes, 2 times L plus 2. So this is what we have, and one of the L's we can replace by an R. So this is, yeah, this works. And if you have the other case, then it should become even simpler. So it's then here the right heaviness, it's not right heavy, so this becomes 0. So it's 1. So this simply becomes size of L plus 1. And of course here this part remains unchanged. So why is that L plus 1 less than, of course L plus 1 is less than L plus R plus 2. Yeah. So this is certainly also the case that this is less than equal this equal this. And here we don't even need a justification because from here to here, yeah, it works for any L and R. Problem is, I still don't have a good graphic image in my head why this works. I can work it out, but it seems my brain isn't wired up correctly for this. And so here we have a logarithmic relationship between the number of right heavy nodes on the left spine is the logarithm of the height is an upper bound. But you can now do the same by swapping. You count the number of not right heavy nodes on the right spine, and then you get a similar lemma about the not right heavy nodes on the right spine and this the number of nodes in the
in the tree. So these two are symmetric, that's why I'm not going into this one. And now the potential is the number of right heavy nodes. This is just recursing down the tree. Why is that? Because merge, if you look at it, here's the code for merge. So merge will always descend on the right. So it'll the R1 and the R2 are always the right trees. And of course, the other part, the other tree, that must be H1 or H2 because that's the tree that you haven't destroyed. But here you have a choice whether you go down the right tree or the left tree, the one that you have destroyed. And here, because merge always descends on the right, right heavy nodes are bad. So that means the potential is counts the number of bad nodes because those are the ones that make things go slower, and so you have to have a enough potential to pay for them. And then comes the lemma. This says that the potential difference, so the actual time plus the potential difference, is bounded by this expression here. This is the number of right heavy nodes on the left spine after the merge plus the number of call them left heavy nodes on the right spine of the two. And you can somehow see, because we're swapping, it makes sense here to count the opposite that we're counting here. Why this is the right potential, you really have to do the math. There's no good intuition I can offer you here. So it happens to work out really easily. This is the proof of this lemma, but does that give you any intuition? I'm afraid it doesn't give me any intuition. You just accept it, and you can work out the details. These are some of the details, but by going through them, you don't get a better intuition of what's going on. At least I don't. So let's not do that. And then the main proof, I think, isn't too bad, but so this is where we want to, what was the lemma about? The lemma had a similar left-hand side, but here we are bounding it in terms of these number of left and right heavy nodes. What we want in the end is this one, but bounded by the logarithm of the sizes of the two trees. And so this is what we're doing here in the next step. So it's the same expression here. And now we know by this lemma that we had that it's bounded by this. And now we go and start manipulating that, because the number of left-right heavy nodes is bounded by the logarithm, and similarly by the step from here to here, that's what we proved here. We proved the logarithmic relationship between these number of left or right heavy nodes and the size of the tree, and we're now using this relationship to replace these counting of left-right heavy nodes by a logarithmic bound in terms of the size of the trees, because that's what we are after in the end. And so we're just replacing them by logarithms of sizes. And then I think what happens here, here we're just using a simple lemma that the size of the merge is simply the sizes of the subtrees. We're just playing around with a one here, never mind that, plus minus one. So that's just this part. And this, I think, must be here we're getting rid of the minus one, and then it becomes greater or equal. And now I think we're using some logarithm lemma. So here we have sums of logarithms, and so we're combining these two logarithms into a logarithm of a sum, and using this lemma that
that if you sum logarithm of x and y, it's less than equal twice logarithm of x plus y if x and y are greater than zero. That's a simple logarithm power. So if you take the power of two of both of these sides, it comes out easily. And so that was combining these two, and now we're combining this one and this one using the same lemma. I think, not even using the same lemma, it's the same term. And then it's two times and one times, so you get three times. So this is really the key step, the first one, where you add up the left and the right heavy nodes depending on where before or after, and then the rest is just logarithm manipulations and these lemmas about the left-right numbers and the size. Yep. And insert and delmin are then easy consequences that the potential, the actual time for an insert plus the potential difference is in this case bounded by three times the logarithm plus two, and similarly here, three times the logarithm for delmin. So they both have also logarithmic complexity amortized. And this was really a groundbreaking paper. I'm sure it's got thousands of citations by Daniel Slater and Robert Tarjan. Of course, Tarjan received, I'm not sure when he received his Turing Award, maybe around that time. He's one of the father figures of algorithms. And Daniel Slater was his PhD student. And they had a number of influential papers that were about amortized complexity of very basic data structures like these skew heaps. And I must say, of course, it's written in 86, you have to take that into account, but if you read that paper, I find it a bit heavy going because it's phrased in terms of an imperative language, and the amortized complexity analysis becomes, I mean, it's very wordy. There are not so many formulas in it, but long texts that if you add this and then you subtract that, and then the pointer moves there. So not my cup of tea. And then Barry Schumacher, who was a PhD student of Anne Kaldewey, the two of them together took this paper and you could say algebraized. I'm not quite sure what that is in English. Algebraized, yeah. And so that's essentially what you've seen here is a slightly tuned version of their papers. And they achieved two things. A, they turned it all into functional programming and algebra, and no more kind of indirect explanations on pointers or something. And B, they actually derived a tighter bound. So instead of 3, you can actually derive the bound 1.5 times the logarithm. Yep. So then come the splay trees. And they are even a bit harder to explain than these skew heaps. So you may have come across them in algorithms lectures. We have formalized them. And it's both the skew heaps and the splay trees were invented by Slater and Tarjan. And the skew heaps were heaps. Splay trees are binary search trees. And again, self-adjusting in that you move things around to hope that the future operations won't be so expensive. And all three functions is in insert and delete have amortized logarithmic complexity. If you wonder why it's called a splay tree, the word splay means something becomes wider or more separated. And here's an example of the word splay. The river splayed out into a delta. And so
display tree is something that is tries to become wide and not deep. That's the idea behind it. So, algorithm, how does it work? Implementation is simply a binary tree, and the key operation is an operation called splay that takes an argument A, and it searches for that argument A in the search tree, and it ends up at some point X, at some node with an element X in it, where either it has found the element, so X is A, or X is a leaf node. What does leaf node mean? It really means that X, well, I think this isn't quite accurate. What I mean by this is X is a node of this form, where X is in the middle, but one of the two, why don't I draw a tree? X, but one of the, at least one of the two other trees must be empty. It could be that both of them are empty, so you have a leaf here and a leaf there. That's what I would call a leaf node. But that's not the only possibility. It could also be that you're searching for X and you stop when you find, sorry, you're searching for A and you stop when you find either A or you find that A isn't in the tree. And you can find this already at this point. You don't, if you look at the subtrees and see, okay, they're not, X is not equal to A and they're both empty, then we can stop here. We don't need to go on. But it could also be like this, I think. If you have a 5 here, for example, that one is some big tree and another is empty. This is really the empty tree here. This can also happen because if you go into that tree and search for 7, then you know it's not going to be in there. So you can stop here. So this, I have to correct this, is a leaf node isn't quite the right point. I should say where either you found it or you, X is the last, is the place where you really can determine that it's not in the tree. And then you move X to the root of the tree by rotations. That's the idea. And you can very naively motivate it like this, but that's not really a good explanation of what you're doing. You say, okay, I've searched for X. Maybe I should move X to the top because maybe the next search will also be for X. Sorry, I've searched for A. Or search for X. Let's assume we are in this case here. I've searched for X, and so I should move X to the root because next time there's a certain likelihood that next time I'll be searching for X again. But it turns out this is not an, people initially argued that way. So there were previous papers that did something very similar to splay trees, and they argued in terms of likelihood, of probabilities. That's much too complicated. You can, in the end, ignore those probabilities, and you can just do a standard amortized complexity analysis, except that before Theta and Tarjan introduced this amortized complexity, people didn't know about it and did more complicated things. So the is in, insert, and delete operations are derived. You first do a splay A, and then you perform an is in, insert, or delete action. So what does that mean? Let's see if we can explain this. So you splay with A, and then how do you check whether the element is in the tree? How can you now check that in constant time? Yeah, if it's the root. Insert, you play with A. If A is afterwards the root, then you don't need to do anything. And if it's not the root, then you you do a little bit at the root to insert the element A there. So we'll see that. And delete, I think it's similar. If you find the after the splay, you find A is at the root, then you remove it, and then you just replace it the largest element on the left of the least element on the right. I think we'll come to that. I hope so. So yeah, key idea is move to root by double rotations. And so these are the two actions. If you if this is your element A and you want to move it to the root, this is where you put it, and then naturally the B and the C have to go here, and the trees have to be arranged like that. And there's the alternative arrangement, you have it like that, and then the B comes here to the top, and the A and the C move to the left and the right, respectively. And zigzag can actually be explained in terms of two single rotations, but zigzag is not two single rotations. If you do two single rotations in this situation, then you will end up with a different tree, at least I think, otherwise it wouldn't be on the slide. Let's see if that's correct. So you start out with this tree, so you have C, B, A, and I ignore the subtrees, let's just see what happens, because it's clear where they have to go. And if I do first a single rotation of A and B, then I get A here, B is larger, so it goes there, and C stays there. And now I do another single rotation, and the C is larger, so the A goes there, and I guess we would get this one, unless I'm mistaken. And that is the, and there's something wrong with what I've done here. I think this step is correct.
B, I think, needs to go to the left of C.
Because B is smaller, it needs to go to the left. Thank you. And so you see, this is what two single rotations give you, this is what a double rotation gives you, and that is the key insight, because there were publications beforehand that did something similar, but they used only single rotations, and they didn't get the same nice results. I'm actually at a loss to explain why this is better than this one, but it is. And so you have this splay function that takes an element and a tree and gives you this new tree where the thing that you searched for has moved to the root, or the closest element, the element closest to what you searched for moves to the root. And there are many cases. Let's just look at one of them, and that's at two of them, the zigzag and the zigzag case. If I do the picture, then we have the zigzag case would be BC. Yep. So we have the B. Sorry, it's C at the top. A B here, then you have to the left of the D, B, and you have some other big tree there, a non-empty tree. So the assumption is what you're playing with is below B and C, and here is a non-empty tree. And so the first thing you do is you recursively splay in that big tree here, and the result will be a non-empty tree, because if you splay with a non-empty tree, you get a non-empty tree back. And so at the end of the recursive call, we will have something like this, A and B and C. And then you rearrange it like that, that the A moves to the top, then the B becomes here, and the C becomes there, and the other subtrees are moved in there. So you're combining this, the recursion with the rotation, so you, when you come back up, you do the rotation, and so you first have to recursively splay this subtree, and then you get the result, and then you do the rotation to that
alternative.
And similarly for the zigzag case, it's the same principle. So this is what the splay function looks like with many additional cases. So there's some base case, like here, if what happens here, let's check that, let's figure that out. If x is less than b and you splay here, these are base cases because this trees might be A and B might actually be empty, and then you just move the X. You're playing with X and you find X actually, and then you move X to the root, and then of course B has to come on this side. What is this one? X is less than A. So you have to go into this subtree, and this one is empty. I think this is precisely the situation that I talked about beforehand, where you find the X is not in the tree, because it's below A, but below A it's empty, and so therefore we have to put A to the root. Yeah, A becomes the new root, and so on. Yeah. The functional correctness proofs, they follow the standard approach that I outlined much earlier, and they can be automated. So the amortized analysis really requires a lot of work, and you can find it there. And I will just give you the top level presentation. And the potential is the sum of the logarithms of the size of all nodes. If you have a non-empty node, it's the potential of the subtrees plus the phi of the node itself, and the phi is the logarithm of the size of the node plus one. So this essentially, this recursive definition realizes this description here. And then the amortized complexity for splay is the actual time for splay minus the potential difference, potential after minus potential beforehand. And this is the key theorem. If you have a binary search tree and your node LAR is one of the subtrees of T, then the splaying with A, splaying with the element that's actually in the node, is here you get some logarithmic bound. This is a logarithm, here is another logarithm. So this is a logarithmic bound. And as a corollary, this tells you, right, you search slowly. What's this? This says if your element is somewhere in the tree and you splay with it, then you get this logarithmic bound. That's a difference between the size of the whole tree or the logarithm of it and the size of that subtree where you find the thing. And now you can specialize it, and if the element is somewhere in the tree, then you get as an upper bound this term where you have simply drop this one, because it could be in the worst case, the element is somewhere near the leaves, and then this term here essentially becomes one, and therefore this is an upper bound. So now you get really your upper bound. Remember, the phi function is just the logarithm of the size. And then in the end, you get this easy corollary. If you're a binary search tree, then the splaying is always bounded by the binary logarithm of the size. Even if the A is not in the tree, that's another special case that works out as well. And finally, from here to here, you're losing the assumption that what you're playing with is in the tree, So from here to here, you need some additional lemma to make that step, and this is the additional lemma. That's quite nice.
So what we're saying here is that this lemma essentially tells us that we remove it, and it just means first telling it works. This lemma tells us that if we're playing, here we're playing with something that we assume is in the tree. If we play with something that's not in the tree, we might as well have played with something that is in the tree, namely the element that we found at the end. So playing with something that isn't in the tree is just the same as playing with something in the tree. So that's what this lemma says. If you have a non-empty tree and it's a binary search tree, then your play AT, where A might or might not be in the tree, has the same effect as playing with some A prime that is in the tree, namely the one that's closest to A, and in fact the time is also the same. So you have the same effect and you take the same time as if you had played with the element that is in the tree. So here in this example, if you play with 7, it has the same effect as playing with 5. Ah yes, and this is what the insert function now does. So this is really, this is the end of the amortized analysis, and this is the most difficult part. This is a lengthy proof. But let's just look at what insert and delete do. So if the tree is empty, we just make it into a single tree, and otherwise we play with X, and then we look at the result of what comes out. We compare the root element with A, and if they're equal, well then you don't need to do anything, you're inserting something that's already in the tree, so you just return that thing that the display gave you, this tree LAR. If on the other hand X is less than A, so you were searching for something, you were playing with an element X, and you got something at the root that is that is bigger than what you played with, then you simply, you take this tree here and you manipulate it slightly. You take as the left subtree L, then X in the middle, Y X in the middle and A to the right, because X is less than A, that's the less than, and then you have the right subtree there and you just insert an empty subtree. So you just changing the tree a little bit, so it becomes a bit deeper, one level deeper, because you are adding this element that you're inserting, the X has been added to it, and you have this tree, and in order to insert it, you have to add another level to it. So you pay a little bit of a penalty, and this is the greater, and it's just dual. you're just adding the element near the root. And you get something, you get a factor of 4 times the logarithm rather than 3 times the logarithm. So you're paying, I think for the splay itself, it was 3 times the logarithm, and the insert, because you're introducing this new level, might be 4 times. And delete is a bit more complicated, but I think it's exactly what that's, it's not exactly what I said. Right, so what do we delete X from T? If T is empty, there's nothing to do. Otherwise, you play with X, and then you get a new tree back, where something has been rotated to the root. If that something is actually equal to X, well, that's, then you have to delete this something here. And if the left tree is empty, that's great, because then you can just return the right tree after this is empty and this is deleted. And otherwise, you don't do what I said. I said earlier you go through the tree and get the either the largest one of the left subtree and move it to the top. But you have a special function called splaymax. So splaymax does something like moving the maximum element to the root, but it doesn't do it naively in the sense of just removing it and putting it at the root, but finding it and then by rotation moving it up. So this playmax function also optimizes the tree a little bit on the way up. And then it has that minimal element, or maximal element, sorry, at the root, and then you just you do this. Why is that? Because the what happened to r prime? Oh, because the maximum element r prime must be empty. And then you get here, you get even a factor of 6 because you have additionally had this more work to do in displaying the subtree. Now, just a comment on splay trees in functional programming. Remember what we argued, that Amherst analysis only works for single-threaded uses of the data structure. Otherwise, you can get the data structure into a bad state and then keep applying the same extensive operation to that bad situation, like we did here with the incrementing the counter, so that you have lots of ones, and then you keep on incrementing that bad situation and do that multiple times. The first time it's okay, but this is not what you should be doing. That is not single-threaded. You're reusing the bad a number of times. Now, the isIn function normally has this type, a tree and an element, and it gives you a Boolean. But since for amortized analysis it has to be single-threaded, the isIn function would eat up the tree. Now, that's not a nice thing for an observer function to do, because then you get the answer back, but then you can't use the tree again. So otherwise, you can do the same bad thing. You can build an unbalanced play tree. You can ask isIn a number of times, and then you get a very bad performance. So the solution is, the first one is, that your observer function always returns a new version of the tree, the one that you got by splaying. That's perfectly okay. So this is how you can define it. You splay with the thing that you search for. When you ask yourself, is A in T, you splay with A in T, you get some new tree. If it's empty, then this is false. If it's a non-empty tree, you compare with the element that you're searching for, and you return a pair of this new tree, and sorry, this Boolean value and the new tree. So this is an easy implementation of isIn in terms of splaying. The client itself uses splay before calling its root. That's what I was puzzled by this one. Here you call splay yourself, and then you ask yourself, is that element that you that I searched for, is that the root? But this actually works. Because you might think its root should also eat up the tree, but here we have a special case, namely the observer function is actually a constant time function. You just check whether something is at the root. So there you don't have to eat up your data structure. You can allow the is root test multiple times on the same data structure. So this is a special case. And the essence is that whatever you do, splay trees are not ideal for functional programming, because in some sense, either you return a new data structure with every observer that makes your code very cluttered, because you have to really, even at places where you don't manipulate the data structure, or you think you don't manipulate it, you have to manipulate it, because even observer functions like isIn cause the tree to change. It's not the ideal data structure for a functional implementation. This is even, I think, right, the splay trees were in 85, so they were just 1 year before the skew heaps, and it's the same authors, and
it's now itself adjusting by the search trees. And again, the same order that we saw earlier, the PhD student, he in his PhD thesis analyzed both of those data structures and gave phrased the analysis in a nice algebraic fashion. And next time I will explain pairing heaps and say more on, or give you an overview of what other standard data structures from algorithms courses have been verified in Isabel. We're not going to go through those verifications, but I'll just give you sort of a rundown with a few explanations. And that's it for today.